We were the perfect couple online. Two dreamers chasing sunsets in a van, documenting every smile. But behind the filters was something darker. Bruises. Fear. Silence. Then one day in Wyoming, I vanished. My fiancé drove home alone. I never made it back. Weeks later, they found my body. And a notebook. His notebook. What it said would shatter the nation. This isn't just a true crime story. It's my voice from beyond the silence. And I need you to hear me. Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you, Vanished in the Wild, a Van Life Tragedy. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. The Road Always Promised Freedom. The van was supposed to be our dream. Our escape hatch. Our fresh start. I used to stare at that dented white Sprinter like it was a spaceship capable of carrying us far, far away from every version of life we were trying to unwrite. The van didn't have much: two faded solar panels, a DIY bed platform that creaked every time we shifted our weight, and a tiny camp stove with one working burner. But in every photo we posted, it gleamed like some golden chariot. Back then, I believed the stories we told. We left Florida in early July, the heat clinging to us like a second skin. Brian had that usual spark in his eyes, this mix of adrenaline and obsession. He couldn't stop talking about the route, the footage we'd shoot, the gear he still wanted to buy. We'd spent months planning this trip, curating playlists, building out the van, setting up our vlogging schedule, pitching brand deals. We were going to make it big. Two lovers on the road, documenting raw van life, sunsets, instant ramen, roadside yoga. You know, the authentic stuff that people click for. We wanted subscribers, followers, affiliate codes. And I won't lie, I loved the attention. It felt like proof that we were doing something real. Something worth watching. But here's the part one never shared online. The truth beneath the filtered snapshots and soft guitar music playing over our YouTube intros. Brian had a temper. Not the kind that flares up once in a while and fizzles out with an apology. No, his anger was quiet at first. Subtle. It crept in like a draft beneath the door. So small I convinced myself it wasn't even there. He used to squeeze my hand too tight when he didn't like what I said in a vlog. He'd delete clips I recorded when he didn't like how I looked. He said it was about branding, about consistency. But I felt it. The control. The possessiveness. Like every inch of me belonged to the channel first, and to him second. By the time we made it to Colorado, I started waking up in the middle of the night with this heavy, sinking feeling in my chest. A knot of dread I couldn't untangle. We'd lie there in the van, his arms slung over me like an anchor, and I'd stare at the ceiling, wondering who I was becoming. The worst part, I didn't say anything. Not to my mom. Not to my best friend Kayla. Not even to myself. I just posted more. Smiled wider. Wrote longer captions about how grateful I was for this adventure, for this life, for this man. I became fluent in my own lies. A storyteller hiding her bruises between the lines. Things hit a breaking point in Moab. We had been fighting all day. Over nothing and everything. The heat was unbearable, our water tank was nearly empty, and the Wi-Fi had been dead for 2 days, which meant no uploads, no DMs, no brand replies. Brian blamed me for picking the wrong campsite. He screamed so loud, a couple hiking nearby actually paused and stared. That night, he broke my phone. It was so fast I barely understood what happened. 1 second I was texting Kayla, just a simple, "Can we talk later?" And the next, he ripped it from my hands and hurled it against the red rock behind us. The screen shattered into 1,000 tiny pieces that glittered like stars under the moonlight. I stood there frozen. He didn't even look sorry. "You know what you do to me," he hissed. "Why the fuck do you always have to push?" I backed away from him slowly, like he was some animal I wasn't sure how to approach. He slept in the van that night. I lay outside on a tarp, under the sky, wrapped in a blanket that didn't keep the fear out. The next morning, we didn't talk about it. We packed up the van. He turned the music on like nothing happened, some indie folk bullshit with banjos and tambourines, and drove like we were on our honeymoon again. I filmed a reel at a gas station, smiling through it all. My caption said, "Rough day yesterday, but the road is full of second chances. Sending love to all our fellow van lifers out there." I even added a peace sign emoji. I think I was trying to convince myself more than anyone else. Wyoming was supposed to be the healing point. That's what Brian called it. Fresh air, big sky, clean slate, he said as we pulled into Grand Teton National Park. The landscape was breathtaking, towering peaks, alpine lakes, golden sunlight flickering between pine trees. It should have felt like a reset. Instead, it felt like a countdown. He was quiet that day. Not cold, not angry, just quiet in a way that made my skin crawl. Like he was having entire conversations in his head and didn't feel the need to let me in on any of it. We drove deeper into the park, past trailheads and lookouts, until we found this secluded dirt road near Spread Creek. There were no rangers, no cell towers, no people. Just us. Alone. He said he needed space. Got out of the van. Walked into the woods. I remember watching the tree lean, waiting to see his silhouette come back. I waited 15 minutes. Then 20. Then an hour. I tried calling for him. Brian. Nothing. The sun was setting. The mountains were turning gold and lavender. A wind picked up, and the temperature dropped. I told myself not to panic. He probably just needed to cool off. Clear his head. Maybe he was taking pictures for the vlog. Maybe he needed to scream into the trees or cry or something. But the truth was already creeping in, whispering at the edge of my mind. Something was wrong. And I fucking knew, that nothing was ever going to be the same again. Chapter 2. The missing piece of me. I used to think the worst sound in the world was silence. But I was wrong. The worst sound is your own voice cracking as you call someone's name, over and over, and no one answers. That night near Spread Creek felt like it went on forever. I sat in the van, curled up in the driver's seat, rocking slightly, arms wrapped around my knees like a child. The forest outside was dense and unforgiving, pitch black except for the small flicker of the van's dome light. My throat was dry from yelling his name into the trees, my voice ragged, useless. I could still hear it echoing in my ears. Brian? Brian! But it never bounced back with a reply. Not even a twig snap. Nothing. Just silence. Crushing, paralyzing silence. I waited until sunrise. And when the morning light seeped through the windshield, revealing the dust coating everything inside, the panic set in like wildfire. He still wasn't back. Not a single footprint near the van. No note. No signal. No sign. Just gone. I started the van, drove back toward the main road, heart pounding so loud I could barely think. Every turn of the tires sounded like a countdown. My stomach twisted with nausea. This wasn't like Brian. Say what you want about him, but he was a planner. He wouldn't just disappear into the woods without telling me. Not unless he meant to. I stopped at the first ranger station I could find. Told them my fiancé went hiking the previous evening and hadn't returned. They asked basic questions, his age, height, last known clothing, any known trails he might have used. I rattled it off with trembling fingers. My voice shook so bad I could barely remember the date. I wasn't wearing shoes. I hadn't slept. And I kept repeating, he left me. He didn't come back. He just left me. That's when they asked if I wanted to file a report. And I froze. Because I had no idea what the hell was happening. I didn't file anything that day. I don't know why. Maybe I didn't want to believe something was wrong. Maybe I was afraid. Or maybe deep down, in that part of me I'd tried to smother for months, I already knew something was very wrong. And filing a report would make it real. So instead, I drove. Aimlessly. For hours. Back through Jackson. Past motels and gas stations we'd visited just days before. I kept thinking I'd spot him. Walking barefoot on the side of the road, backpack slung over his shoulder, looking lost but alive. But he wasn't there. No one was. Just tourists with selfie sticks and strangers with backpacks. All of them smiling. All of them so blissfully unaware of the hellstorm that was starting to brew. 3 days later, I showed up at his parents' house in Florida. Alone. When they opened the door and saw me standing there without Brian, the silence between us was deafening. His mother clutched her chest. His father stepped forward asking, "Where's our son?" I didn't know what to say. Because I was still waiting for the answer myself. It took 5 more days for the world to catch on. The first article dropped on a small local news site. Something like Florida woman reported missing after van life trip with fiancé. They didn't get the details right. They never do in the beginning. They said I was traveling solo. Even though that wasn't true. They said I possibly separated from my partner, like it was a miscommunication or a lover's spat. No one used the word violence. Not yet. But TikTok did. God did TikTok. Within 48 hours, my face was everywhere. Influencers with true crime pages were dissecting my last Instagram post, zooming in on my pupils, analyzing the curvature of my smile, counting the bruises on my forearm. Some girl made a 30-minute YouTube breakdown of our last vlog, pausing frame by frame to prove I was scared. Hashtags exploded. Hashtag find her. Hashtag vanlife gone wrong. Hashtag where is she? And then came the questions. Where's the van? Where's Brian? Why isn't he speaking to the police? Because here's the twist. After I vanished, Brian came home. Alone. He drove the van all the way back to Florida. Parked it in his parents' driveway like nothing happened. Didn't say a word to law enforcement. Didn't call my family. Didn't answer a single message from my friends. Just posted up in his childhood bedroom and pretended I didn't exist. I wasn't missing to him. I was erased. By the time my mom called the Northport Police Department, it had been 10 days since anyone had seen me. And just like that, I became a case number. The next few days played out like a fucking circus. Police showed up at Brian's house. His parents stonewalled them, said he wasn't available, that he needed a lawyer, that they weren't sure what happened. They never even asked if I was okay. I mean, imagine that. Your son comes home from a cross-country road trip without his fiancée, with the van they both shared, and you don't even pick up the phone to call her family? You don't ask where she is? You don't care? That's when I stopped hoping he'd turn himself in. That maybe it was a misunderstanding. That maybe he was scared. He wasn't scared. He was hiding. And I wasn't missing. I was gone. The FBI got involved next. They labeled Brian a person of interest. Not a suspect. Just someone who might know something. It was laughable. The internet was losing its mind, tracking his movements, digging up every photo, every comment he'd ever left on Reddit or Instagram. One guy on Twitter even found surveillance footage from a convenience store in Wyoming that allegedly showed the van a few days after I went dark. It had a dent near the rear bumper that wasn't there before. But the biggest break? That came from other van lifers. A couple going through their travel footage noticed something strange while reviewing dashcam video. Parked off the road in a remote part of the Tetons was our van. Alone. No movement. No lights. That was the last known location. And it changed everything. Search teams were deployed. Canine units. Drones. Thermal cameras. The whole country was watching. But by the time they found my body, by the time they realized what Brian had done, he was already gone. Chapter 3. What He Left Behind. When they found my body, the world stopped pretending. For a moment, just a moment, every fake smile, every maybe she's okay, every TikTok theory evaporated, and all that was left was this jagged, brutal truth. I was dead. No more speculation. No more hope. Just headlines. Remains confirmed to be missing van life blogger. Cause of death, strangulation. I'd like to tell you that someone held my mother when she got the call. That the officers who knocked on her door spoke gently. That the earth didn't crack beneath her feet. That my father didn't sink to the floor, sobbing into the wooden floorboards while clutching a framed photo of me from third grade. But I wasn't there to see it. I was lying in the soil at Spread Creek, alone, exposed, cold in a way no one should ever be cold. My body had been out there for weeks. He left me like I was nothing. Not a human. Not a partner. Not a daughter. Just a problem he could bury under brush and leaves and move on from. Brian didn't even try to make it look like an accident. There were bruises. Defensive wounds. Ligature marks. They said it was blunt force trauma mixed with asphyxiation. There was no mystery. No wild animal. No fall from a cliff. No tragic accident on a hike. It was up close. Personal. Hands around my neck. Long enough to watch the light drain from my eyes. That's not a mistake. That's a fucking decision. But this isn't just a murder story. It's also a story about what happens after. About how quickly the world can turn your pain into content. About how grief becomes headlines and crime scenes become hashtags. Once the FBI confirmed my death, the internet didn't stop. They doubled down. Influencers posted tributes in front of Grand Teton backdrops. Vloggers created monetized breakdowns of our final days, complete with dramatic music and slow zooms on screenshots of our text messages. People I'd never met suddenly claimed to be close friends and gave exclusive interviews to gossip sites. Even the candlelight vigils turned into photo ops. I wasn't a person anymore. I was a trend. But the one question everyone kept screaming, whispering, obsessing over was this. Where the hell was Brian? He vanished the same way I did, but with one key difference. People protected him. His parents, to start. They claimed he went on a walk the day the FBI named him a person of interest. Just stepped into the woods near their Florida home and never came back. Like he was taking a damn nature break. They didn't even report him missing until 4 days later. Let that sink in. Their son came home without his fiancée. Refused to speak to police. Refused to speak to my family. Then went for a walk and vanished. And they just let him. Didn't call anyone. didn't alert the authorities, didn't even seem worried. The FBI launched a manhunt across the state. Parks reserves hiking trails. Helicopters scanned marshlands. Dogs sniffed through thickets of brush and muddy trails. Journalists swarmed the laundry house like mosquitoes, hurling questions through chain-link fences. Social media lit up with tips. I saw him in Alabama. He's hiding in Mexico. He shaved his head and changed his name. None of it panned out, because the truth was quieter, more tragic, more final. They found him 23 days later, or what was left of him. It was a dry, windless afternoon in Florida when investigators discovered partial remains in the Carlton Reserve, submerged in swampy waters alongside a dry bag and a journal. Dental records confirmed it was Brian. Gunshot wound to the head. Ruled suicide. No final words spoken. But there was that journal. That goddamn notebook. Water-stained. Half-decayed. Pages blurred from rot and time and blood. And on one of the surviving pages, written in his sharp, slanted handwriting, was a confession. A final, delusional letter to the world. He said he loved me. Said he couldn't go on without me. Said he ended my suffering because I was injured during a hike and in too much pain. He wrote that it was a mercy killing. Let me repeat that. He said strangling me was mercy. As if that makes it better. As if that somehow wipes his hands clean of the violence, the gaslighting, the control. As if I didn't scream. As if I didn't beg. As if I didn't fight for my fucking life in those final moments. That wasn't mercy. That was murder. The journals shook the world. People split into factions. Some called him a monster. Some blamed his parents. Others tried to twist the story, claiming maybe he was telling the truth, that maybe I was hurt, that maybe he panicked. But those people don't know what it feels like to live in fear. They didn't hear him yell when the camera wasn't rolling. They didn't feel his hand tighten on their thigh during an argument, or watch his eyes go black with rage over a missed turnoff. They didn't wake up in the middle of the night in the back of a van, heart pounding, wondering if the man they loved was capable of killing them. I did. And I was right. There were protests after that. Demands for justice. For change. For better response protocols for missing persons. For better protections against domestic violence. People screamed about the system, about how long it took to take me seriously, about how many other women like me vanish every year without hashtags, without headlines, without help. But none of that brought me back. None of that let me say goodbye. None of that gave me my future. I was a daughter, a friend, a creator, a dreamer. I loved hard. I laughed loud. I wanted to matter. And now my story is told in past tense. Because of a man who said he loved me, and killed me instead. Chapter 4, A Nation Obsessed. They called me America's daughter. That's what one anchor said during a primetime segment, her voice trembling, eyes glassy, as if she had known me. She spoke of my free spirit, my bohemian charm, how I had captured the hearts of millions with my sunshine smile and adventure-filled posts. And just like that, the world decided who I was, what I was worth, what kind of girl I had been. But let me ask you something. Why me? Why did my story become a wildfire, while so many others flicker and die out in silence? I was gone less than a week before hashtags exploded. Within days, influencers with ring lights and perfect teeth were covering my disappearance like it was the latest Netflix docuseries. Podcasts popped up overnight. People built timelines, analyzed satellite images, mapped out potential burial sites with the precision of military operatives. Armchair detectives gathered in Reddit threads with digital pinboards, magnifying my TikToks, replaying my last vlogs like they held the secret to a national mystery. The whole world seemed to care. And yet, that care felt hollow, performative, profitable. I was trending before I was found. That's the part that hurts. The morning they confirmed my death, there were already hundreds of Etsy shops selling Justice for Gabby t-shirts. People cried over me on live streams. My parents were bombarded by news vans on their front lawn. My childhood photos became stock images. My final moments were dissected like plot twists. And I couldn't say a damn thing. I couldn't tell them who I really was. I couldn't explain the truth behind our smiles. I couldn't stop strangers from deciding I was either a helpless angel or a reckless girl who chose the wrong man. They simplified me into a soundbite. A blonde, pretty, all-American girl with big dreams and a tragically poetic end. But here's the bitter truth. The one the cameras didn't like to focus on. I wasn't special. I was one of thousands of women, missing, murdered, abused, every single year. I just happened to be the right flavor of tragic at the right time. My face fit the mold of sympathy. My story had just the right amount of Instagram romance and wilderness danger. The algorithm liked me. The public ate it up. But what about the others? What about the indigenous girls gone missing on that same land, in those same woods, whose names never made it past a footnote? What about the black and brown women whose families begged for help, for airtime, for the same resources they gave to me, only to be told their loved ones were probably runaways? What about the women whose bruises didn't come with a curated online presence? The ones without sponsorship deals or influencer followings? Where was their manhunt? Where was their FBI press conference? Where were their hashtags? I'm not saying I didn't deserve the attention. I did. Every person who goes missing deserves to be searched for with that level of urgency. Every woman in danger deserves to be believed the first time she says, "I think something's wrong." Every mother who loses a daughter deserves a search team that doesn't need TikTok to give a damn. But I shouldn't have been the exception. And yet, I was. It makes me sick to think about the girls who died quietly, alone, forgotten, who didn't trend, who didn't get forensic analysis from influencers with affiliate links under their videos, who didn't get candlelight vigils covered live on Fox, CNN, NBC, TikTok, Twitch, and Facebook Live, all at once. The media fed on me like vultures. And the public? They mourned me in between ads. There was a documentary before the dirt on my grave had settled. A dramatized reenactment by the end of the month. A podcast network bought rights to develop my story for a limited series. And what did my family get? Paparazzi parked outside their grief. My parents couldn't walk into a grocery store without someone whispering behind them. My little brother got stopped at school by classmates asking, "Is it true he strangled her?" My best friend Kayla got doxxed online because she wouldn't give interviews. Every piece of my life became public domain. My journals. My playlists. My last text messages. My fucking ring size. People I hadn't spoken to since freshman year suddenly came forward with memories of me for articles. Girls who barely knew my name were quoted as close friends. Everyone wanted a piece of the tragedy, because being part of the tragedy made them visible. But beneath the frenzy, beneath the algorithms and clout chasers, there was a deeper pain. A guilt that pulsed through the country like a slow, festering bruise. People started asking the right questions. Why did it take so long for the police to take me seriously? Why did they let Brian go home without detaining him for questioning? Why didn't my fear register as evidence when I told friends? He scares me sometimes. Why didn't I leave sooner? God, I wish I had. But that's the thing about abuse. You don't always see it until it's far too late. Love is a clever disguise. Control feels like protection at first. Possessiveness wears the costume of devotion. And manipulation? It whispers so sweetly that you confuse it with care. People want to believe women just walk away when it gets bad. But the truth is, sometimes we don't know we're in danger until we're in the dirt. There was a mural painted in my honor in Brooklyn. 100-foot wall of my face with a sunflower crown and the words, "She was light." They meant well. I know they did. But I wasn't just light. I was also rage. I was fire when pushed. I was laughter that filled rooms. I was messy and flawed and loud and real. I wasn't perfect. And I shouldn't have to be in order to be worth saving. I want people to remember that. I want the girls watching this, hearing this, feeling this to know. You don't need to be a viral post to matter. You don't need to be perfect to be believed. And if you're scared, if your love is hurting you, please, for the love of whatever pieces of me still echo in this world, tell someone. Don't wait. Don't stay. Don't convince yourself that silence will make it stop. Because the silence is where it starts. Chapter 5. The closure they don't tell you about. Closure. That word gets thrown around like a finish line ribbon after a long, ugly race. They say you get it from funerals, from courtrooms, from press conferences. They say time brings it. That grief becomes manageable. That wounds heal. But here's what they don't tell you. Closure is a myth. There's no neat ending when your life is taken in pieces. There's no resolution when the last words anyone hears from your killer are lies written in ink that bled from swamp water. There's no calm when your voice, your actual living voice, is replaced by strangers speaking for you in documentaries, interviews, TikToks, think pieces, and anniversary specials. What does closure look like when your parents sleep in your childhood bedroom just to feel close to you? When your friends can't hear your favorite song without pulling over to cry? When the place you died becomes a landmark that people visit like it's a tragic photo op? Closure is not a finish line. It's a war zone that never stops ringing in the ears of the people left behind. My mother hasn't stopped searching. Not physically. She knows I'm gone. She held the funeral, kissed the closed casket, scattered sunflowers across the altar like it would soften the blow. But inside her, there's still a girl in the woods calling for help. That girl is me. And my mother? She's still running, every single day, toward that voice she'll never reach. She runs awareness campaigns now. Advocates for domestic violence victims. Fights for missing persons legislation. She's become this accidental soldier in a war she never asked to fight. She doesn't sleep much. My father? He hides his pain in silence. It lives in the stiffness of his shoulders, the way his hand trembles when he thinks no one's watching. Sometimes he mows the lawn 3 times a week, just to feel like something is within his control. They don't talk about Brian anymore. Not because they don't want justice, but because he's dead. And you can't put a corpse on trial. You can't cross-examine a coward who left this world the easy way. And you sure as hell can't get answers from a journal that reeks of manipulation and martyrdom. So instead, they remember me. Not the girl in the crime scene photos. Not the victim in the headlines. But me. The barefoot kid with chipped nail polish and dirt on her jeans. The teenager who built a dream from a camera and a secondhand van. The woman who believed love could fix broken things. They say time softens the pain. That's a lie. Time just changes it. It turns screaming into silence. Shock into a dull ache. Memory into ritual. My best friend Kayla writes me letters every month. She reads them aloud, even though I'm not there. She lights a candle and plays our old road trip playlist. The one with Fleetwood Mac and Phoebe Bridgers and that one god-awful Chainsmokers song I used to love. She tells me things about her job, her new apartment, the guy she's been seeing. She tells me she finally got the tattoo we talked about, a small sunflower on her ribs. I think I would have teased her for crying so much when she got it. She says she sees me everywhere, in roadside diners, in dusty thrift stores, in the morning light when it hits her bedroom just right. That's what grief does. It follows you, whispers from the shadows, stings when you least expect it. I didn't get justice. Not really. Brian's death robbed me of that. No courtroom drama. No trial. No final statement. No apology. Just a bullet in a swamp and a notebook full of revisionist bullshit. Some people call that karma. They say, well, at least he's dead. But that's not justice. That's avoidance dressed up as consequence. That's a getaway car at the edge of accountability. I didn't need him to die. I needed him to admit what he did. I needed the world to look him in the eyes and hear him say, I killed her because I wanted to control her, and when I couldn't anymore, I decided she didn't get to live. But he never gave me that. And maybe I wouldn't have believed him, even if he had. The thing that keeps me alive now, ironically, cruelly, is that people remember. Not perfectly. Not always for the right reasons. But they do. Young girls send letters to my family saying my story helped them leave abusive partners. Women speak up now, whispering less and roaring more. People take screenshots of bruises. They save voicemails. They trust their gut. Police departments review policies. Social media platforms add safety features. And slowly, slowly, laws begin to shift. I became a symbol. Not by choice. Not because I was better or braver or more deserving. But because I was visible. And in that visibility, people began to see themselves. Their fear. Their silence. Their second chances. Their survival. I am not just what happened to me. I am the breath between songs on a road trip. The shadow behind a camera lens. The laughter in a van at midnight. The wind curling through a mountain pass. The warmth of a hand held tight beneath 1,000 stars. I am still here. In every woman who walks away. In every voice that trembles then steadies. In every bruise documented. Every red flag noticed. Every friend who listens. I am not closure. I am warning. I am awakening. I am the lesson written in blood no one should have had to learn. So if you're hearing this, if you're sitting in your car or cleaning your kitchen or crying in the bathroom because something in my story sounds too damn familiar, listen to me. You are not overreacting. You are not imagining it. You are not unlovable. And you sure as hell are not weak. Leave. Tell someone. Save yourself before someone else has to put your picture on a flyer. Before someone writes your story in past tense. Because I promise you, the hardest thing in the world isn't leaving. It's realizing you should have.